Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are David Wessel, esteemed economist at the Brookings Institute and former economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and congressional candidate for Iowa 3, Sarah Trone-Garriott. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicsworldroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now I'm going to get to as many as we can, but please tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Mint Mobile, Trust and Will, and Quince, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, Michigan primary, big news. Dr. El Sayed, a left-winger, won the Senate primary, barely. Two others from the left captured House primaries in the state. This is a major achievement for Dr. El Sayed, who had been seen earlier as just a fringe candidate. The bad news is he may have a hard time winning in November, which would hurt Democratic chances of winning the Senate. Let me just offer what I think is some perspective here. Dr. El Sayed beat a weak candidate by a point. Moreover, the third candidate, Mallory McMurrow, who I think would have been the stronger one-on-one against El Sayed, dropped out a month ago and still got 4% of the vote. So therefore, he got about 48% and the others are 49%. The others got 51 or 52. So say in the 13th congressional district, where left-winger William Lawrence won with 40% of the vote, two pretty good mainstream candidates, a former ambassador to Ukraine and an ex-Navy SEAL, split 59% of the vote. That's what happens when one left-wing candidate runs against two mainstream candidates. And also in Missouri, a major Democratic socialist, Cori Bush, a former congresswoman, was soundly beaten when she tried to oust an incumbent. And a socialist who once called for abolishing Thanksgiving may win, however, next week in Wisconsin's Democratic primary. But, you know, I hope this may tamp down the wildly exaggerated media narrative that the socialist left are taking over the Democratic Party, like the Tea Party did with the Republicans in 2010. The House challengers, and we have interviewed now about a dozen of them this year, are overwhelmingly mainstream Pelosi-type Democrats. Candidates like Rebecca Bennett in New Jersey and Kate Conley in New York beat rivals on the left. With the Senate, you mentioned earlier, Iowa's Josh Turek and Texas's James Tallarico. They beat left-wing rivals. The two biggest Democratic challenges this year are Roy Cooper of North Carolina and Sherrod Brown of Ohio. This is not a left-wing party. They win in selective areas given unusual conditions.
Okay, here we go. Michigan. First of all, let's look at this 30,000 feet for a second. You know who carried Michigan easily in 2016? I do. Bernie Sanders. All right. You know who carried Michigan in the Democratic primaries of 1972? Well, George Wallace. All right. So Michigan, but let's be fair. I don't think he's DSA, but he's clearly a DSA-backed candidate. Got 48.5 in the Democratic primary in Michigan. That cannot be denied. They feel like they're an ascendant wing of the party, that they represent the future of the Democratic Party. We can go and point out, well, you didn't get this, you didn't do that, we won here, we lost there. This is my singular idea. First of all, how much El Sayed wins by or loses by in November is going to profoundly affect the Democratic nominating process for president in the year 2028. If he were to lose, I'm just giving you a different hype. If he loses, that's the end of it, have any progressive Democratic nominee for president's chances. It dies right there. Let's just say that he doesn't, that he wins. And but he doesn't win by very much. He should have won by more. What you got to do is we all got to run for president. And the direction of this party can only be determined by people that vote in its primaries. It can't be determined by talking points. It can't be determined by talking heads. It can't be determined by quants. All right? It can only be determined on the field of play, and that's running in the 2028 primaries. So this is an enormously consequential event. This is an enormously consequential general election on at more levels than I can imagine. I mean, the United States Senate is worth a lot. Whoever party wins, going to have somebody for 6 years. But its ramifications to 2028 are going to be gigantic. And there's no way to avoid this fight. We're not all going to come together. We're not all going to say, look, we can, who can win, who can't. This should be determined by voters in Democratic presidential primaries, and that's the direction we're heading in. Anything else doesn't matter.
Yeah, look, looking forward, which is smarter, but just looking back for a moment, I think some blame rests with Democratic leaders in Michigan and Wisconsin. Two Democratic governors in both those states, they should have worked harder to get the strongest candidates. They apparently did not. And I also want to say a word about Mallory McMurrow, who dropped out of the race. She got 4%. I think what she did was really a selfless act and a smart act. And I think if she had been the nominee in head-to-head against El Sayed, I believe she would have won. One Democrat told me that she became, unfortunately, the candidate of MSNBC, now MS Now. Next time, Mallory, you still have a really good future. Spend a little more time in small communities, union halls, and less on cable television. And another point, in the 13th Congressional District, William Lawrence, I think he's a Democratic Socialist, he won that congressional race when two moderates split the vote. But he said something very revealing. Earlier, he criticized black leaders as pillars of the Capitol establishment standing in the way of white leftists. The left's base is elite whites.
You're 1,000% right. And it's just simple. Black people do not view themselves as part of the problem is not that they're part of a larger oppressed class. Their problem is very specific that they're black. And Mr. Lawrence just can't believe that they don't have the same worldview he does, which, by the way, the most important, loyal group in the Democratic Party is far and away blacks. That's why any idea that would diminish the importance of South Carolina has to be squashed like an ant. And I already know what's going to happen. You're not going to do very well. You're not going to do very well because all you people do is talk the talk. And I know black people, and they want somebody that's walk the walk, and you're not one of them. You ain't walk no walk anywhere in your goddamn life. So we just have to go through this, and we can point out what you did. They're just say whatever they want. By the way, the press loves it. They love this story. They're addicted to this story. That there's a turmoil in the Democratic Party. There's a fight for primacy. It's for the soul of the party. The Republicans have their crazy wing. The Democrats have this. You can't stop it. You can try to reason with it. You can try to negotiate with it. You cannot stop it. The only way that you can stop it is at the ballot box. And that's what we got to turn our attention to. And we'll see. This is either going to be Hassan Piker's party or it's going to be the party of the congressional candidates that we had on.
And tell us who Hassan Piker is, James.
Oh, he's some guy that's got a podcast and he's about there campaigning with El Sayed. He's going to his events. And Hassan Piker is, from everything I can determine, is a raving anti-Semite. I mean, just look at what he said. And I've said this before, but he and I, somebody ain't going to be in this party in a while. I don't know who it is, but the long-term prognosis of me and Hasan Piker ever being in the same tent politically is about nil.
That's a pretty easy choice.
I don't know. I got to figure my own way, but right now, his guy won in Michigan.
He campaigned with him.
And he's going to continue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Enough on the Democrats. One more topic before we go. And that's your president, my president. To those doubting that Trump is losing it, just look at the last couple of days. The back and forth on Iran. He's a bloviator. He just bloviates. A war he desperately wants out of, and he doesn't know how. So what does he do? He threatens, he springs, and then he backs down. But my favorite was when he demanded a criminal investigation of the mess that he created in Washington's reflecting pool. They indicted some poor guy, and all the evidence made clear that what happened with this historic landmark, huge pool there that leads from the Lincoln Memorial, that it was a botched up refurbishing job by a company that Trump had hired and ordered to do this. So facing an embarrassing day in court, where they'd be humiliated once again, the U.S. attorney in Washington, a Trump ally, dropped it. And Trump went ballistic. Threatened her, said she panicked, she folded like an umbrella. I'm sorry, you know, it was you who screwed up, Donald Trump. And the reality is, the overarching view or sense here is that the big celebrations that he talked about for the 250th anniversary of America will be remembered as a disaster. Fortunately, there were some wonderful other celebrations in small towns and communities across America.
So I want to talk about the Iran war. Right? And let me put it in very simple terms, very true and very to the point. We have, by all accounts, press counts, inventories, everything else, our munitions supply, that's ammo, okay, ordnance, is dangerously, dangerously low. All right? He shot our wad. Yeah, we shot our wad. You understand what happened? That's what the President of the United States did, which is what? Then we come to the point where we're over-deployed. Parents of sailors under Abraham Lincoln are begging their congressman to look into what's going on. Basically, conditions aboard our aircraft carriers become almost inhabitable. This is the United States of America, the most powerful person. We have 11 aircraft carriers. I don't think China has one. We can't get them deployed in where they're totally combat ready, when, as they should be. The parents are calling in. Now we have a story, and a true story, is the brass is asking the troops for any idea how to beat Iran. Yeah, you heard that right. The senior military people are going to sergeants and said, you got any idea how we can do this battle? Because the shit ain't working right now. We are in the middle of losing a war. The only way to deal with that is to acknowledge it. That's what this guy has done to us. We've shot our wad. Our munition supply is down to dangerously, hyper-dangerously low levels. Our carriers and sailors are horrifically over-deployed. And the brass, we've gone from General Donahue, maybe the best soldier of the 21st century, to the point of some guy to be chief of staff of the Army, and the Republicans are going, wait, this guy is not even competent enough to do this. This is how, if we don't realize that we are in the middle of losing a war with a depleted military, with a increasingly incompetent command structure, then we're missing the whole point. And we got to be honest with ourselves. We really do. We're not honest with ourselves. We shot our wad.
Yeah, it is humiliating. Okay.
So sleep cool and clean with Miracle. It was hot everywhere. It used to be I had some expertise in heat. I don't anymore. Everybody's caught up with me. So this is not a geographic-specific product. This just applies to in Alaska.
You know, if you wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable, it's time to upgrade. The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. That's why you need to switch to Miracle-Made sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long. Sleeping at the right temperature is a critical way to feel rested the next day, and whether it's too hot or too cold, Miracle-Made sheets truly give you maximum comfort. They make pillowcases and comforters also. Plus, thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle sheets require way less laundry days because they stay clean and fresh 3 times longer. Not only is that fewer wash cycles, but it's great for your skin. Hidden bacteria can clog your pores and cause acne, so sleep cleaner and clearer with Miracle. With no more gross odors, life's a whole lot better for your household. So join us in getting better sleep every night. Not only are Miracle-Made sheets smooth, breathable, and ridiculously comfortable, they don't have the steep price tag of other luxury brands. Miracle sheets feel nicer than bed sheets used by some 5-star hotels. So if it's a vacation when you get into bed. I imagine myself in Paris where I'm taking my wife, but it's your call. Choose Miracle to upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/warroom to try Miracle-Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use promo code warroom, you'll get an extra 20% off, plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/warroom with the code warroom at checkout. Thanks to Miracle-Made for sponsoring this episode, and the link is in our show notes. James, our guest is David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institute and formerly chief economics correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. David, months ago, the worry from Trump and a lot of economic experts was over a possible recession. You know, could we, we need to cut, the Fed need to cut interest rates. And Trump kept pressuring Powell. Now it doesn't appear there's any recession on the horizon, but really renewed concerns about inflation. What brought that about?
That's a really good question, Al. I mean, it's a reminder how hard it is for even people who pose as experts to predict what's going to happen to the economy. I think it's a huge surprise how resilient the U.S. economy has been, despite all the stuff that Trump has done to screw things up. The conventional wisdom, and I think there's something to it, is that whatever weakness there has been in the economy has been overwhelmed by all this business investment related to data centers and AI, mm-hmm. and it's really propelling the economy in the short term. But the other reminder is that the U.S. economy is much more resilient than we sometimes anticipate.
Let's talk about inflation then. Is Kevin Warsh, Trump's guy at the Fed, Trump hoped he was going there to cut interest rates. That's not going to happen. The question now is, might he be under pressure in the months ahead to increase rates, as 3 members wanted to at the last meeting?
Well, yes. And actually, 3 people who voted on the FOMC said they wanted to raise rates. And at least 2 of the presidents who aren't voters also called for, they said they would have voted if they'd had a vote, because you know it serves in rotation. Look, we don't really know, but yes, it looks, the markets expect that the Fed will have to raise interest rates later this year. Inflation has been stubborn. It's not all oil prices. And when you have a fairly strong labor market by conventional measures and persistently high inflation, and you tell everybody we're going to bring down inflation, at some point, the Fed is going to have to say, well, looks like we need a rate increase. Look, when you're in a, you have a reasonably strong labor market by conventional measures, not for everybody, but on the whole, and inflation is persistently above your target and hasn't shown much signs lately of coming down, and you've promised to deliver inflation at target, at some point you have to raise interest rates. It looks to me like There was a good reason to wait one meeting or two meetings, but I think the markets are right that unless we have some unexpected good news on inflation, Warsh is going to have to raise interest rates, and we'll see how the president reacts.
Speaking of the markets, David, we worked together for 20 years, so you are acutely aware of how little I know about the bond market. So tell us now, what is it doing? What makes it tick? I mean, what messages is it sending, and what are the implications?
Well, wasn't it Carville, or was it someone else who said, in my next life, I want to come back as the bond market?
Yes.
Yeah. it looks like, to the extent that you can ever understand what's going on, is that the markets are a little bit uneasy about what's happening in the U.S. They don't have confidence in Kevin Warsh yet. They see what Trump's doing, and so they're demanding a higher interest rate to buy long-term treasury bonds, and that's going to ricochet through the economy. It's going to raise mortgage rates, and this happens at a time when, despite the fact that we are on an unsustainable fiscal debt trajectory, all Congress and the president can do is make it worse. Every time they touch this, they add more to the debt. And it's beginning to show a little bit on interest rates, I think.
Yeah. Let me switch subjects, and I think James will probably pick up on this. Capital One, a bank, 2021, closed 385 bank accounts. We've now learned of Trump and his family. Trump sued, claiming political bias. Capital One says they did it because there was money laundering. It's a really serious allegation. Do we know much more about that?
Someone does, but not me. Look, I think the problem is that we put a lot of pressure on the banks to be careful about opening accounts or handling accounts for people who they thought were doing things that were not proper. And we know that banks have gotten a lot of grief when they kind of went too close to the edge, all the problems they've had with the Jeffrey Epstein thing. So the banks are cautious. Trump wasn't the president. He does have a rather loose relationship to accounting and the law and paying back your debts. So it's not hard to imagine that somebody at the bank said, like, we ought to throw this guy off. And then Trump says, oh, it's all because you don't like me politically. But I don't know much more than that. But I can understand why a bank would do this and why they regret it today, because I didn't expect he'd be reelected president.
James.
So I think this is ramifications. This is a huge minimum. I guess some people, the bank won't take your money, but for the most part, they're pretty glad to have it. I mean,
right.
It had to be something more than just a minor flag for this.
Yes.
App. So you said something, and I want to go back to it. Even though I started doing this 45 years ago, I don't know, something like that. In my mid-career, there was one issue that just everyone was absorbed at. Everybody acknowledges, and that was the debt, the deficit. Yeah. Can it be this percent of GDP? Do you have to have, you have to cut Graham Latner, Rotman, everything you can think of. If you take this away from something, you have to make a makeup here. And the CBO numbers would come out. What's the CBO going to say? I got to wait to see what the CBO said. And this literally, Obama tried to surrender to Paul Ryan. And they wouldn't let him. Thank God, because they were going to surrender everything. And then one day, and you had the Peterson Institute, and they would crank out volumes of shit. Nothing from Fog and tells it was actually pretty good and pretty accurate. And everybody agreed on one thing. That we have to, Democrats say we got to address it through taxation. Republicans say we can do it through spending cuts. Some people say it's a combination of both. Some people say, well, we need to cut defense spending. And is there enough in foreign aid? One morning, the entire country woke up and didn't give a shit. Okay. If you borrow in your own currency, there's no way that you can ever get in trouble. There's no, and I don't understand. Will never profess to be, but I got a feeling this shit's gonna bite us on the ass. He just said that, and we're not even talking about it. We're not thinking about it.
Right, I think that's right. So what happened was that all the people who warned that when the debt was at 35% of debt to GDP, that it would be catastrophe if we got to 40. When we were at 40, it would be a catastrophe if we got to 50. And now we're at 100% of debt to GDP, and we haven't had the catastrophe. And right. until relatively recently, we could borrow, the U.S. Treasury could borrow at very attractive rates, slightly less attractive now. So it's very hard to say that this is going to be a disaster if we don't do anything, because, you know, Bob Rubin said it would be a disaster in 1990, and that was a lifetime ago. But so there are a couple of things we know. One is,
wait, just so we know, for the record, the budget was balanced in 1990.
Right.
Okay.
What's happened is that I think a couple of things. One is, when interest rates are low, you don't worry about how much you're borrowing. And we went through a long period, a luxury of that. And it turns out that even if sometimes we think our economy is a mess or the debt's a mess, it looks relatively good compared to other countries. So people kept investing their money in the U.S.
Right.
And what's frightening, so we know we could borrow more than we used to think. But when you look at the projections, and the projections are based on, we're an aging society, we have low fertility rates, healthcare continues to rise faster than other things, this thing goes up and up and up. And you say to yourself, okay, this can't go on forever. And it can't. But no one really knows when is it going to be too much. And I think you're right. Both the bond market and the public have given the politicians a pass. Because if the bond market doesn't care about the debt, and I haven't seen any people picketing on front of the White House saying, please cut my Medicare or raise my taxes, why should the politicians deal with this? And so for the moment, we're enjoying this luxury of, we can borrow a lot of money and we don't have to pay a lot. But if you look 10 or 20 years into the future, when you look to the fact that Social Security Trust Fund is going to run dry and that'll be a big political event, you know that at some point they're going to have to do something. We just don't know what the trigger is.
So, David, I become friendly with David Jolly, who's a Republican turned Democrat running for governor of Florida. But he was like the budget guy. He's actually a scholar of debt and deficits. And I mean that in a kind of complimentary way.
Right.
And when you talk to him about the accumulation of debt just under Trump, and if you took, let's just say, let's give Trump 6 years, and the total U.S. debt is $40 trillion. If you extracted out how much he did in 6 years compared to the other 239 years, of no, what is it, 250 minus six, 244 years, it would be eye-boggling. The percent might even be more than half, just under him. And I just feebly point out, and you did, and we went through it, to people bored to death on this podcast, we're talking about something that you're going to start hearing a lot more. I don't know when, neither is Mr. Wessel, but it's coming.
Right. So you're right. And the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and the One Big Beautiful Bill Act added a lot to the debt. There was some spending over COVID, during COVID, which everybody agrees was a good idea, but that added to the debt. But the problem we have now is there's no sense of responsibility on the part of any of our political leadership to do anything about it. And nobody wants to make the first move, because why should I talk about cutting spending if you're not willing to raise taxes and vice versa? So I think the two action forcing events I see are, one, if the bond market really does start to raise interest rates a lot, and it can be pinned to not only a loss of confidence in the Fed, but the deficit, that will become an action-forcing event. And the second is the imminent, the Social Security Trust Fund running dry. Now, it doesn't mean that nobody's going to get their full check, because we know that when push comes to shove, Congress will just borrow to pay the checks. But that has in the past been a moment that gives them some excuse to do something, because instead of saying, we're dealing with the federal debt because the Peterson Foundation says it's dangerous, they'll say, we're going to fix Social Security so it's sustainable for the next generation, and that might be more politically appealing. But it's going to take some leadership and some courage and some bipartisanship in Congress and some leadership from the president, all of which are completely missing now.
Thank you, Albert. Very good. Thank you.
David, The U.S. intervened to help the Japanese yen. It's no surprise that Japan has challenges. But the U.S. intervention was a bit unusual. I think it's the first time in 15 years. Why? And what does it imply about us, if anything?
Well, I think the fact that the U.S. intervened to help Japan is not an aberration. It hasn't happened in a long time, but Japan had to deal with a rather substantial fall in their currency. And from time to time, the U.S. has joined other countries in helping them to support their currency. What's interesting about this one is the way in which they did it. The U.S. did not use dollars to support the yen. They used euros from their stockpile of euros. And they're taking steps to help the Japanese avoid selling any treasury bonds in order to get dollars to buy yen. And what this looks like to me is that the treasury is a little worried about anything that could make it look like that any of this intervention would raise long-term interest rates in the bond market more than they already are. And so the fact that they have to move so gingerly because they're worried about the treasury market is a rather worrisome sign. I mean, when you are the world's largest borrower, you don't want people to think you're a little nervous. And the way they did this made them look like they were a little nervous. And I was surprised about the way they did it.
Well, that brings me to the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent. He certainly ingratiated himself with Trump, and he plays the tough guy. But how is he viewed by the business community, markets, and our allies?
That's a good question. I haven't done a lot of reporting on this, but I would say that they think he's the adult in the room, but that says more about the other people in the room than it says about him. I'm told that in private, he can sound quite reasonable, although must be a hell of a boss. He's had more turnover in the Treasury than you had at the Wall Street Journal when you were the bureau chief, Al.
I always kept you, Wessel. I always kept you.
And so, I mean, there's a lot of vacancies at the Treasury. So I worry that he spends too much time saying things in public that he knows appeals to the president without thinking through the consequences of what that does to our credibility with the rest of the world.
Jay Powell, savaged viciously by Trump when he was Fed chair, criticized even by some Democrats like Larry Summers. In retrospect, doesn't Powell deserve pretty damn high marks for his 8-year tenure?
In general, yes. We did a big event a couple of weeks ago at Brookings looking back on his thing. I think he made some mistakes, which he owned up to. They were too slow. They misread the economy. We got more inflation than they thought we would. But in general, I think his monetary policy was pretty good, but his obit will say he stood up to Donald Trump when Donald Trump tried to pressure the Fed. And when you think about the long run, you know, you get interest rates wrong, you fix it, you get a little inflation, it'll come down eventually. Maybe it's a problem, or maybe it hurt the Democrats in the presidential. But ultimately, his courage in standing up to Trump and protecting the independence of the Fed will be his lasting legacy. And I think that's pretty much what the view we got at here.
I agree, and you're too young to know this, but that's in contrast to one of his illustrious predecessors, Arthur Burns, whose legacy was tainted forever because he did not stand up for the independence.
And I think two things are interesting to me. One is, you'll remember this, Al. Do you remember when Alan Greenspan replaced Paul Volcker? Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people who said, oh my God, he's never going to measure up to the great Volcker. He's a political hack and all that stuff. And then when you look back, you know, made some mistakes, some of which contributed to the global financial crisis. But overall, he looks like a pretty, pretty good job. And so I think when people judge Kevin Warsh, they have to remember that, you know, the first couple of months can be kind of shaky, but that doesn't mean that he's going to be a failure. And I believe that Kevin Warsh knows about Arthur Burns, and that he's a little bit, I worry that he's too reluctant to take on the president, but ultimately he wants to be seen as a successful Fed chairman, and he knows his term will go beyond Trump's term. So while the next 6 months, particularly before the midterm, he's got to do this delicate dance. And if they don't raise rates, people are going to say it's because Trump told him not to. That's going to be a hard thing for him to deal with. But I think ultimately he will learn the lesson of Arthur Burns, which is like, you know, written in stone there in the men's room at the Fed.
Yeah, I was going to say, if he does, he wants to know more, ask me. I actually covered that, so I know that Burns story backwards and forwards. David, final question from me, and James, I'm sure, has a couple more. You know, the economy, I think you mentioned this earlier, has been carried really heavily, the economy and the market, by AI investments, right, and the data centers. A lot of controversy on the, on these data centers. I mean, this is a, if this thing starts to shake at all, that could really be a huge problem.
Absolutely. You know, it does have some of, it's hard to know what's happening here. Is this like the beginning of some incredible boom in business investment that's going to propel the economy for another 5 years? Or is it a bubble that's about to burst? It could be either one. I'm not sure which. But you're right that for now, that's what's propelling the economy. The data center things is really interesting. I think it's a symptom of something other than just people don't want this data center in their neighborhood. I think there's a lot of suspicion of these tech companies for good reason. I think I heard a real estate economist say that now some of the home builders are worried because the data centers are paying so much for land, it reduces the amount of land that the home builders can afford to buy, and that's not a good thing if you want to build more homes. So I think it's a symptom of how scared people are about AI and how distrustful they are of these big companies and the rich people who run them, who like are look like they're going to control the world if we don't do something.
Right. James?
So I want to see if I got this right, because what you said, as I think about it, it's like, so Japan simultaneously holds a lot of U.S. Treasury debt, and at the same time was having a currency crisis. Its currency was the value was going down. So they go to us and say, either we got to do something. We either got to sell our debt in dollars to prop up our currency, or you can do it for us and we won't sell our debt.
Exactly.
The Treasury Department made the conclusion it's better for us just to give you the money and prop it up.
Exactly.
And
the reason is that, you know, these things, someone said, it's hardly an original line, what happens in Japan doesn't stay in Japan. You really don't want, they don't need any extra tension in the financial, I mean, the markets have been right. doing great, okay. but the world, a lot of us look at the markets and say, like, are they not paying attention? Like, sure. you know, like we are on the verge of a continuing war in the Middle East forever, the Russia-Ukraine thing, the all the questions about corruption in our government, the challenge to the rule of law, trying to bar immigrants so that we don't have the kind of people we need to both help in nursing homes, but also the PhD students who are going to propel us in the future. And you look at this and you say, like, man, this is an accident waiting to happen. So I think what the Treasury is saying is, yeah, there's a lot of kindling here. Maybe let's not let the Japanese light a match if we can help give them some water.
The finance minister of India just saw what happened. The finance minister of Brazil just saw what happened.
Right.
The finance minister goes in to see the prime minister, the president, and says, I got an idea how we can make up $250 billion. Just don't tell the U.S. we need to prop our currency up, and if you don't give it to us, we're going to start selling bonds, and they'll give you whatever you want. I mean, we just put, we're open for blackmail.
Yeah, but the trouble is India and Brazil don't own a lot of bonds. The question is China. China's the one that has the leverage.
China has Korea, even worse.
Yeah, no.
We're gonna have a little excursion in the South China Sea. It would be terrible if we had to sell bonds and if we had to really get expensive and we had to sell our bonds. So,
yeah, I mean, absolutely right. Look, you know, we are making ourselves vulnerable by depending so much on the willingness of foreigners to lend us endless amounts of money because we're unwilling to tighten our belts.
You know what Vance Dubois said, right? I've always depended on the kind of strangers. That's the United States. We're depending.
But we're lucky that the other places don't look all that attractive either. I mean, Europe's a mess. Japan, we've discussed. The reason we can get away with this is that the other places look even worse than we do as a place to put your money.
Well, you're a terrific guest. I mean, I wish I felt better after the show that I did going into
it. I'm sorry, that's not my job.
It's the way it is. We asked you what time it is, and well, you told us the time.
And I didn't build you a clock, right, Al?
No, right. Longer, yeah.
That's an inside joke, James.
Clinton would build a Swiss village,
and we're not sure if, and we're still hoping Carbo comes back as the bond market someday. Listen, David Wessel, you are terrific. There's no one better than you in understanding this stuff and explaining it. That was a great value.
Good to see you guys. Take care, Jim.
Good luck. Save on sales service with Mint Mobile. If you don't like money, it's not important. If you do like money, it's very important because it's a really, really good product at a really, really more affordable price than anybody else. So if you're not into having more money, don't do this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because, you know, when we were kids, summer meant freedom. No homework, no teachers, no school. And as adults, summer still means freedom thanks to Mint Mobile's summer sale. Right now, all of Mint's plans are $15 a month, even unlimited. So free yourself from big wireless and their gimmicks and gotchas and switch to Mint for high-speed data and coverage on the T-Mobile 5G network. We found that the website is simple to navigate and you can get down to business in no time. If you're like us, you can't pass on a deal this good. When we say how great the price and service were, we knew everyone should get your kids and other family members using it also. Like you, they have more important things to spend their money on. Mint Mobile took what's wrong with wireless and made it right with premium wireless for $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can bring your current phone and your number. Choose from 3, 6, or 12-month plans and say goodbye to a monthly bill. It's the best deal out there, so ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile. It's so easy. Sign up online and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/war room. That's mintmobile.com/war room. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/war room. That's it. No catch. And the link is in our show notes. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plans required. $15 per month equivalent, taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 GB may slow when the network is busy. Includes up to 20 GB hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com. James, our guest is Sarah Trone Garriott, Democratic challenger in Iowa 3 against incumbent Zach Nunn. Sarah is a Iowa State senator and a Lutheran minister running in a slightly Republican-leaning district centered in southwest Iowa. Let me ask you to start with, there's a lot of conjecture about the Democrats turning far left. It was fueled by the results in Michigan yesterday. I don't agree. I read your campaign positions, restoring Medicaid cuts, expanding the Affordable Health Care Act rather than a single-payer government-run health care, on immigration, a pathway to citizenship after securing the border. That strikes me more of what I would call a Pelosi or mainstream progressive than a left-wing socialist. Is that a fair reading of your position?
So I'm not so focused on what's left or right. I'm focused on what works. And that's what my neighbors here in Iowa really want. We're pragmatic. We want to get the job done. And I think I fit my district really well. So I'm a Democrat that represents a Republican district in the state Senate. And I've got to show up for all my neighbors. And if we can bring folks together, we can accomplish the big challenges that are facing us, really come up with solutions.
Yeah, but you know, your opponent is going to try to pin the left-wing label on you. That's in the Republic, in the GOP midterm playbook. How are you going to address that?
you know, this is what they've done in 20 and 22 and 24 when I ran in the top targeted state Senate races. It never worked on me because people know who I am. I have been serving this community as a parish pastor, working for a food pantry network. I show up for my neighbors as a state senator. I've knocked thousands of Republican and independent doors. I hold open town halls. I am present and accountable to the people of Iowa in a way that my opponent never has been. He's never held an open town hall in the 4 years he's been serving.
Well, you're a minister, a Lutheran yes. minister, but incredibly, your faith is under attack by Republicans and conservatives. They call you a fake minister, even call you a Judas. They say you presided over a satanic wedding. The Des Moines Register and others have reported these are lies. But how do you explain what they're doing, and is it having any effect?
So my ministry and my leadership in the community is my strength. So, of course, they're going to attack it. But this is what they do to anyone who stands up to the corruption we're seeing in Washington. This is, you know, I've been calling out my opponent's votes that are hurting my neighbors, and he has nothing good to say in his defense, so he's going to attack me. People are going to see through it. I was walking in a 4th of July parade recently, and a woman shouted out from the side of the road, "Sarah, you baptized my baby." You know, I have been present for people's important moments, and I've been a part of this community for a long time, and a lot of people know me, and that's going to shine through.
You talked about your opponent, Zach Nunn. He voted for the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. How does that play in Iowa 3?
So right now, that vote is hurting my neighbors. He voted to cut Medicaid and then said it was a myth it was going to close rural hospitals. What we are seeing already is that we've had 3 clinics close in my district. We've had thousands of my neighbors lose their primary care providers. They don't have doctors in their community, and they're having to drive an hour or more just to get basic care. The impacts have been pretty devastating, and it's just starting. And so people are pretty upset about that because we were already having a hard time here in Iowa getting the health care we needed. And we're number 2 in the nation for new cancer diagnoses. I mean, my neighbors need health care. They need to have access for diagnosis, for treatments. They need to just be able to see a doctor to stay healthy. He's not helping that get any better. He's making it so much worse.
James Carville.
So you're famously a pastor, a Lutheran pastor. Tal Rico, is he a Lutheran or Presbyterian seminarian?
He's a Presbyterian seminarian.
It seems like Protestants are making some kind of comeback in Democratic politics. And what is it about your faith and your training and upbringing and everything that informs you as a Democrat today? Because then people will come to you, I'm sure, in certain parts of Iowa and say, well, how can you be a Christian and be a Democrat? And how do you, go ahead and answer that question. It's not very hard, but I'm sure you get it.
Yeah, so no political party has the edge on being faithful in any religious community, let alone Christianity. But the heart of my faith is the call to love my neighbor. So Jesus said there's 2 commandments that are the most important: love God and love your neighbor. And loving your neighbor means helping them. And so that's what I see in the Democratic Party, is that desire to help your neighbor, to show up and to work hard for them. And that is what guides my public service. So I'm running for office because it's another way to help my neighbors, to work with the big resources of government, bringing people together to solve problems. And when I was working as a pastor in the parish, when I was working as a hospital chaplain, when I was working for a food pantry network, I kept seeing how the decisions made at the state and federal level were impacting my neighbors in a negative way, the way it was making it harder for us to do our work. And so that's why I stepped up to run, is because we need people in government who are focused on helping our neighbors and making life better.
So I would suspect that your district, Southwest Iowa, is heavily dependent on the agricultural sector. People are employed in it, or they have businesses that are directly affected by it. Can you just give our listeners a kind of view of the state of American agriculture today And what are the kinds of things, if you're elected to Congress, that you feel like you can do to get agriculture back on his feet? Because I'm pretty sure it's not on his feet right now from everything. I mean, I grew up agrarian, so I know a little bit about it.
Okay. Yeah, so farmers have been stressed for a long time. They've had to get bigger and bigger just to make some kind of profit and keep going, which means there are less and less people actually doing the farming. But still in Iowa, it's a really important part of our economy. So much is connected to agriculture. And the decisions that my congressmen have made, it's hurting our farmers. So he has supported the tariffs, and they have destroyed our soybean markets. They're just destroying the farm economy. And then those farmers were already struggling. They were already losing money on their crops and not having a place to sell their crops. And then he supported this war. And the war has been particularly devastating for the agricultural economy, because right before spring planting, the cost of fertilizer shot up significantly. And so folks are just, you know, they're running through their cash. We're starting to see more foreclosures. They're not buying new implements, which is slowing down manufacturing. It's just this ripple effect that's been pretty devastating. My opponent has said that the tariffs are winning. This does not look like winning to me. He said this war is worth it. It's been pretty costly for the people of Iowa. We need some leadership that's really going to listen to the challenges that farmers are facing and work to make it better. And we have a lot of opportunity through the farm bill, but they've been kicking the can down the road for years with the same old version of the farm bill that's not focused on the future of agriculture. And we definitely need to go in a new direction, help farmers find a way forward. We can't just keep going along in the same path.
So I know a lot of parts of the agrarian sector were hurt by the quote immigration crackdown, unquote. Do Iowa farmers feel some kind of adverse thing in terms of built in a higher seasonal labor or things like that, that agriculture just depends on by its nature?
So with commodity crops, we don't have as much manual labor involved. There's still definitely some, but it's not like picking produce in the fields. But we do need workers to be part of that system. And then also meat processing plants, which are significant here in Iowa, rely on immigrant labor. And so to make sure that there is a path for citizenship, that folks who have temporary protected status are able to hold on to their status and have security and be able to plan and build a life here, you know, that has really impacted that industry. So it's been challenging for labor in Iowa, just in a different way than some other agricultural states.
Yeah, pretty empowering. So I'm going to mark you down as path to citizenship person.
Well, you know, there's a lot of folks in my community who have been living here, working, contributing, paying taxes. So we have a significant Indian community here in the Des Moines metro area. Those folks came to work in the insurance industry and IT, and they've been working towards citizenship for 10, 20 years. It's incredibly expensive. It's really challenging. They are contributing. I think we need to make sure that we can improve these processes so people can, you know, they're building a life here. Let us help them become citizens.
Okay. Well, I got to tell you, Alan and I just it cannot help. Last week we had a congressional candidate from Omaha on. And we've had any number of congressional challenges. I'd say 80% of them have been female. But more importantly than that, and you fit into this, just really impressive people with really impressive credentials for reasons that are kind of inexplicable or offering themselves at this most difficult time in American politics. So I have one question I want to ask before I turn it over to Al. Are you ever encountered in town halls by people that are hear some of the more left-wing messaging that comes out of certain quarters of the Democratic Party? Are you ever asked to comment on that? Or how do you feel about defund the police or no borders or things like that, that you hear people around and say members of the Democratic Party espousing these things? Do they have any potential for blowback in Iowa?
So we have been focused on showing up everywhere and for everyone. And so we did a 21-county town hall tour, a town hall in every county in under 30 days here in the district. Because as I said, my congressman's never done an open town hall. And it's important to show up for all your neighbors and respond to those questions. So, you know, I am of a position that we need to focus on what truly works. I'm not an extreme person, and so I want to find solutions that bring people together and improve life for all folks. You know, so I'm honest with folks about where I am. Not every idea that might work in other parts of the country is going to work here in Iowa, and I feel like I have a pretty good sense of where my neighbors are. They want us to get to work on the things that are really impacting their day-to-day life, the cost of living, the difficulty of finding affordable health care, dealing with the corruption in Washington. That's a huge one for our neighbors as well. I mean, people are frustrated with politics as usual, and they're frustrated with both parties. We've got to do better.
Thank you, Albert.
You mentioned your opponent support for the war in Iran. What's your position? Should we get out now?
Well, we shouldn't have gone in the first place. That's why it's really important that our executive branch has good guidance and real strategy, because this war has been incredibly costly for the people of Iowa at the gas pump and for our farmers with the rising cost of fertilizer. But we also had two Iowa service members killed that first week of the war. We don't want it forever war. We have to find a way out. And clearly, the president is not able to accomplish that. He needs some help to do that. That's why we need congressional oversight of this war. And my opponent has voted repeatedly not to have any oversight.
Trump carried your district. How would he do today?
He's underwater. He's not very popular. Folks are seeing that his promises, he's not fulfilling them. He's not coming through. And it's been pretty devastating for the people of Iowa.
You mentioned several times the ethical issue. Washington really is an ethical cesspool, primarily the Trump administration, but also Congress, the Supreme Court. What would you propose to change that if you're elected?
Well, I think the first and foremost, we need congressional members who are showing up for their communities and being accountable. Then, you know, when you show up for people, then you have to answer their questions. You have to respond for your votes. And my congressman is not doing that. So I think we should require town halls. I think we should require people to be responsive and accountable to their constituents. But in the state legislature, I filed a term limits bill because I don't think any elected leader should just get to treat that position like a lifetime appointment. And I would do the same thing in Washington, because we need new voices and new perspectives coming up through the process. I filed a stock trading ban in the state government because I don't think anyone should be getting rich off of elected roles. It's about serving the public, not serving yourself. And there's a lot of ways that happens, but there was a stock trading ban that was passed by the House recently, and it had no teeth. I mean, it still let people trade stocks. It didn't cover staff. It didn't cover any other members of government. And It really didn't get at the problem. It was only in name. And so we need to address how folks are benefiting themselves off this process. There is no end to the opportunity to address the corruption and hold folks accountable. But that's what the American people deserve, is a government that works for them and not for big money.
Let me ask you what it's like, what it might be like being a minister in a body with very few. I think you're the only minister in the Iowa State Senate. And if you get to the Congress, I think there are only two or three ministers currently in the House of Representatives. What does it make any difference? I mean, does it affect the way you legislate, the way you deal with your colleagues? Is it a plus? Is it not a plus? What?
I think it makes a difference for me. I mean, it's part of who I am. It's what I bring to all of my public service. My faith is really important to me, and it is also an opportunity to find common ground for folks, because I talk about how the call to love my neighbor is really central to my Christian faith. I know that's not exclusive to the Christian faith, that there's folks of a lot of different backgrounds and non-religious folks who take that calling very seriously too. We can find the common ground on that and work together. I think being a minister, though, has given me a lot of experiences of having to work through really hard stuff, showing up for the whole community. I was a hospital chaplain. I walked into the worst moments of people's lives over and over again. And I'm not afraid of having hard conversations and showing up for people. And I know my call is to be there for everyone, not just the people I agree with, not just the people who vote the same way as me. It's about serving everyone.
Well, James, you have anything you want to add to this?
I have a parting observation I want you to comment on. I think in 2026, the Democratic Party of Iowa is fielding a really strong slate of candidates. I mean, up and down, you being one of them for sure, but how do you feel about, you know, running the same ticket with Rob and Josh and people like that in together in this party? Are we going to have a unified Democratic Party going into November? Or how do you look at this situation?
It's really the strength of the candidates in this cycle on this ticket that is giving me so much hope. I ran in 20, in 22, in 24. I was able to win in really tough seats, but I was one of the only ones every one of those years. And it's so exciting to be running with other candidates who are bringing such great energy and strength to this ticket. We are all helping each other, and that's what's making Iowa a place to watch in this election.
I can't wait. I promise Rob I'll try to come. So if I do, I'm going to make sure we swing through the third.
Please come and say hi.
Okay. You can go through Omaha or Des Moines if you want to see the third, James.
Yeah, that's sure. Third casinos across the river.
You have been a terrific guest, and we really appreciate it, Sarah Trung Garriott.
Handle your affairs with trust and will. It's only critical if you don't care if the state allocates what you've done. Because if you don't do this, every state has what happens if you die intestate. That's a fancy word for saying that you die without a will. Wouldn't you want to have some say-so on whatever assets you have, where they go? And you say, oh, man, that's complicated shit. You know, that's for people, you know, like you and Al that have big-time lawyers. No, it's actually not. It's for you. This is affordable, competent, and available, and give you peace of mind like you wouldn't believe. I think this is a unbelievably important product that we're advertising here.
Yeah, you know, a lot of us aren't getting any younger. And with growing families, you want them taken care of. And whether you're 38 or 80, getting your affairs in order gives you so much peace of mind. Unfortunately, a lot of people get overwhelmed by the paperwork or don't know where to start. That's why we had to tell you when we saw that Trust and Will makes the process easy and affordable with pros ready to help. Trust and Will offers affordable, attorney-designed estate plans online that you can create in as little as 30 minutes. Their website makes it super easy to create your will or trust online. It's fast, and in as little as 30 minutes, you can create a will that lets you document your wishes for guardians, asset distribution, and healthcare planning. Plus, their products are state-specific and tailored to your needs, with attorney support available as an add-on. Update your plan at every life stage with a platform that keeps everything organized, updated, and ready, so your loved ones never face the burden alone. You can also share access with trusted contacts to ensure your will is carried out, and most importantly, it's secure. Trust and Will has bank-level encryption and secure sharing features, so your most important information stays protected and accessible. When we went through this with our young producer, he realized that after getting married, it was time to get it done. Now he tells everyone how fast and simple it was. Trust and Will is the most trusted name in online estate planning with thousands of five-star reviews on Trustpilot. Trust and Will, affordable estate plans, priceless peace of mind. Go to trustandwill.com/war room and get 20% off. That's trustandwill.com/war room to get your 20% off. Trustandwill.com/war room. The link is also in our show notes. And now for the outrage of the week. James, if I become an employee again, I want to negotiate my compensation with John Cornyn and Tom Tillis. These two Republican senators disgraced themselves, getting rolled on the nomination of Todd Blanche for Attorney General. In their final months, both are leaving after this year. Seemingly, you'd think they're free of political pressure. These senators raised what we thought were principled reservations about Blanche. I thought maybe they were serious. How naive. Tillis demanded that Blanche, who is Stonewall, the survivors of sexual abuser Jeffrey Epstein, meet with these women. I thought he was serious about justice for the Epstein victims. Blanche held the meeting, treated them with arrogance. They said it was purely performative and accomplished nothing. But it was enough for Tillis, who sold out the survivors and voted for Blanche. Cornyn, at the Blanche hearings, was very tough on the corrupt deal Blanche negotiated to set up a slush fund for so-called victims, like the January 6th perpetrators, but maybe even more importantly, a sweetheart deal that gave Trump and his family immunity from tax audits with current or past returns. Could be worth, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. But when Blanche contended the slush fund was dead, trust me, there are loopholes, and it's not really dead, and did nothing on the unprecedented tax audit immunity for Trump and his family, it was enough for Cornyn to sell out. To repeat, this tax immunity for Trump and his family and company has never been available to anyone else, only the president. They should have insisted these provisions be sent back to the federal court that called out these scams. Instead, they showed that their early assertions of principle really were a scam. So they voted for Blanche, an unethical attorney general who has turned the Department of Justice into an appendage of Trump and his retribution. Absolutely outrageous.
Well, every word you speak is the gospel truth. Why would someone Trump ran against, so you got beat bad. Then you couldn't run for re-election because Trump was going to primary you and you were going to lose. And you know this man better than anybody else. Not only is he obviously stealing everything with both hands, ruining the reputation of the United States, he's ruined you, and you know what the truth is. Why would you go out and do this? It's simple. You were told when you leave the Senate, you're going, like all of them do, you're going to stay in Washington. It would be terrible if the realtors didn't hire you, if the Beer League didn't hire you, if the government of Chile didn't hire you. All right? And the way that you do is you're a team player. You play on the team. And when you come in and you ask for tax breaks, or you want to see a, you want a meeting, and somebody's paying you $50,000 for a meeting with a United States senator, if you're on the team, we can play with you. If you're not on the team, then maybe you ought to go to Appalachian State and teach political science. Maybe you ought to go to Dallas and sit on a couple of corporate boards and never look back. No. You want to be a team player, and the price of the team is to sell you so. And you didn't see any problem with that. A lot of other people, in your defense, a lot of people don't. And now you can get all the meetings you want as soon as you get hired by some big law firm or lobbying shop. And the system will continue. It will continue, and it will continue without interruption because too many people make too much money off of it. It's literally that simple.
Boy. That's really awesome. Is. It really it's is. What a price we're paying.
It's a price. And you know, they'll pay it. You know, we got a team here, son. You're all part of the same thing. And what did Michael Corleone say? Hey, Senator, we're all part of the same hypocrisy here.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well. Style your summer with Quince. Not only is you look going to look great, you're going to save a bucket load of money. And I can tell you, this is high quality clothing. One of the amazing things is just things that we accepted as a necessity of lives, clothing being obviously one of them. The cost of everything is going up. I know everybody faces that. I don't blame you. But the cost of good clothes is actually, in as evidenced by this, is doing pretty well right now. So whatever you save on clothing, you can use for other necessities. But you're going to save by using this product, I can tell you.
August is the perfect time to hit reset before autumn rush begins. And there's no better place to start than your closet. That's why we love shopping at Quince. Quince is all about fewer, better pieces. Their clothes are made with premium materials, built to last, and designed to become the ones you reach for day after day. To fill you in, Quince specializes in everyday staples that work harder, like their ultra-soft organic cotton tees and premium Mongolian cashmere sweaters. They're versatile, timeless, and transition seamlessly from a casual workday to a nice dinner out. If you're still hanging onto the same worn-out basics, Quince makes it easy to upgrade. They have premium denim and tailored chinos from just $60 with the kind of perfect fit, structure, and high-quality fabrics you'd expect from a luxury designer. Best of all, everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. That's because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middleman. So you're paying for high quality, not brand markup. Now, you know, James can look great in anything, but he looks particularly great in their activewear when he's running around on his farm. But another Quince favorite is their luxurious stretch wool dress pants. They feel amazing and are perfect for business on the hill, meeting a source or reading by the beach in style. It's not just clothing. Quince has become the go-to for everything from hotel-quality bedding and bath essentials to premium cookware and travel must-haves. So don't wait. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/warroom. Get free shipping on your orders and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK also. That's quince.com/warroom. And the link is in our show notes. All right, James, now for one of our favorite segments, the listener questions. Boy, they get better every week. The first is from Richard in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. You get it, even though Bryn Mawr is my neck of the woods.
He wants to know
your thoughts on Musk announcing he's dumping $100 million into the midterm this year to help the GOP.
Well, thank you. And if I'm a GOP candidate, all right, what I want is Musk announcing publicly that he's putting $100 million worth $100 million. I actually think this is a good thing for Democrats. He spent, $50 million in Wisconsin.
And lost.
Supreme Court race and lost by double digits.
Yeah.
Musk is a very valuable to Democratic message. And the more money that he puts in to the Republicans, the more valuable he becomes to the Democrats. So, and please announce it. Let us know. Maybe you can have a joint press conference with Mike Rogers and say you're putting another $100 million into Michigan. The more, but be sure that he gets the credit and publicity if he's going to spend all this money. And I think it's a very much a net plus for Democrats.
Okay. The next, since I didn't get Bryn Mawr, the next is from Ben, one of my favorite names, as you know, in Newton, Massachusetts. Ben says, I understand the negative arguments you all make about lefty candidates, particularly Democrat Socialists of America. What I've not heard is the affirmative case on the policy positions that more moderate Democrats are offering. What are they? Well, you know, actually, Ben, first of all, the major platform comes in presidential years. But the Democratic agenda in the midterms and almost 95% accepted by candidates is rather simple. Restore the Medicaid cuts, restore the affordable health care subsidy so people don't have their health care jacked up the way it has been, increase the minimum wage, higher taxes on some of the very rich, and hold Trump accountable. That's a good agenda for 2026.
You can add baby bonds. You can also add the best idea of them all is to remove the cap on earnings to pay Social Security tax. Don't pay infinity. There's a very great historical error that is being made. And that historical error goes like this. It's the same thing, James, as the National League and the American League. Look, you got the Republicans. They're hideous. The establishment institutional Democratic Party is as much a part of the problem as anybody else. We all know that. Now, let me say something very clear. Since the beginning of the last century, Democrat, institutional mainstream Democrats, and I'm going to include Teddy Roosevelt now. I know he didn't have a D after his name, but he did. Is the single most successful governing party in the history of the world. There has been no political party in the last 125 years that has brought about child labor laws, changed it in entire way. Look at things, brought in the women's right to vote, stopped having state legislatures, elect United States senators, defeated the Depression and all the leverage and everything went on, defeated Nazi Germany, established a program that almost eradicated elderly poverty in the United States, brought about the entire civil rights movement, was a political party, the only one in the last 80 years to ever balance a budget or bring a modicum of fiscal responsibility, extended health care for another 20 million Americans, all right, led us to a comeback from a disastrous financial crisis that was induced by the other party and their policies. And here we are right now, and we're out telling people fucking lies that the institutional establishment Democratic Party is just the same as anything else. And we need a revolution in the party, and it's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. I'll give you a perfect example. Bernie Sanders. Okay. Not to mention Bernie Sanders, but to mention Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders says, I'm an establishment Democrat. First of all, what the fuck is an establishment Democrat? So let me get this straight. Bernie Sanders goes to the University of Chicago. It's $100,000 a year. I just looked it up on AI. It's $75,000 after it's $100,000 a year. Place I went, it's $10,000 a year. He was a land developer in Burlington. He was a mayor. He was a United States senator. He's in committee. He ran. I'm the establishment? Really? I'm the institutional Democratic Party? Really? And these people just say this stupid, jackass, vacuous, vapid nonsense. And I hope one day people have enough sense to look at what happened, and let me just say this again as clear as I can. The single most successful governing party in the history of the world is the Democratic Party from 1900 to 2025. By my count, 125 years. Period. Not close. Nowhere. Done. Over. But let's throw that shit out under the banner of something new.
Okay, Laura, in another one of my favorite places, Raleigh, North Carolina, asked you, James, what's the best way, this is the negative side of what we're talking about, to combat Trump's latest campaign that Democrats are all communist and the greatest threat to America, greater than World War I, World War II, 9/11, Vietnam, or any other conflict.
So one of the funniest things in all of the Marines, some guy would go through the barracks, say, here comes a sergeant, here comes a sergeant. And I'll never forget a friend of mine, it was back, this is a long time ago. He goes, here's a quarter, call somebody that gives a fuck. Okay. Like, no one cares what he says anymore. And look, communists, we're everything. And the best thing to do is just let him go. It's really funny that somebody that has occupied so much of our space and our minds, our thoughts, our words, they don't give a shit. The Iranians, they don't give a shit. The market, they don't give a shit. The market decides what to do. It doesn't care what Kevin Walsh does. And we got to adapt. The Europeans, they're going on with their own future. They don't give a shit. And the Democrats, we have to make our own future. And no one else listens to anything he says. Neither should you.
Good advice. Pete in Stamford, Connecticut, says, what do Republicans or Team Mitch McConnell gain by hiding his well-being? The seat's going to be held by a Republican, so why are they doing this? That's a really good question, Pete. Yes. Obviously, Senator McConnell has had a very difficult recovery from whatever he had. But he or his staff have made the whole situation much worse by not being transparent, by suggesting things that appear not to have been the case. He's a 84-year-old man who is in his final months, and I'm sure he wants that final great celebration for his long service in the Senate. But they aren't gaining anything by seeming to be duplicitous on this. Just be transparent. If he's going to be in the hospital for another 7-8 weeks, say it. I just find it really, really perplexing, James.
I think we agree, maybe one of the smartest people you and I have ever known is Walter Dellinger. Okay, this guy's great. He said something utterly brilliant. Mitch McConnell on his own changed the composition of the Supreme Court from 9 members to 8.
Right.
It's just it. So we don't need 9. We're just going to have 8. I'll put it as constitutional amendment. I'm Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, I don't know the reason. This is really weird. And the guy's 84 years old. He's obviously had health issues. And, you know, what people suspect is he's trying to hang on to keep the United States Senate as much as he possibly can to not go to 49. Members. He's going to hold on to cling to that, you feel me, number of Republicans. He's going to cling to that and change the composition of the Senate. That's exactly what's going on now. He's not going to, I don't know what the truth is. Most people, when you get to be that age, you suspect what's inevitable is going on, but I don't know that. He is, maybe he's on his deathbed, maybe he's walking around. He's changing the composition of the United States Senate just as he changed the composition of the Supreme Court. In ways that the founders.
Well, the Senate is 52-47 without McConnell.
Right. It's a hard
thing. Which actually slightly advantages the Democrats. So I think this is more a case just of either McConnell or his staff deciding they don't want to be transparent. Maybe it's because it's more serious, but I think they made a mistake here.
I don't know. But one next, most, that's right.
Danny and Ogden, Utah.
Oh, James, wow.
This is a really good question. Why is it that when a crazy from the left gets in the spotlight for extremist views, it is assumed that they represent the whole party, i.e. the current media craze about the Democrats are now being taken over by the socialists? But when a crazy from the right does it, they're assumed to be outliers.
Well, boy, is that a question that just, if we're going to give an award for the question of the year that we vote on, you might have just asked it.
Danny, you're right up there.
Yeah, this is my analysis. All right. First of all, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party desperately wants that to be true. Second, the whole right-wing sphere, information sphere, Fox, podcasts, talk radio, they desperately want that to be true. And I've got to tell you, a lot of the kind of center-left leaning commentary, including press entities of great respect, they like this story. This is an easy thing to report. Both sides have their crazies. Forget that they're totally in the level of crazies, a totally different kind of crazies, totally different composition of the party. This narrative is so satisfying to so many people. And the people that try to correct the narrative look like old scowls, ancient people trying to cling to some antiquated view of the world, and we're getting beat. And they're defining us in ways that are totally not true, but it's totally to the benefit of too many people to try to turn it around. But thank you, and to the extent that people listen to this show, they can get an answer. But it was a brilliant question, and it's so true, so true.
Yeah. No, it really is. Danny, you're in our top tier for great questions. Charlie in Louisville, Kentucky says his favorite quote, Harry Truman, how many times do you have to get hit over the head until you figure out who's hitting you? Will Democrats ever find an effective communicator like Harry Truman again? I'm beginning to believe we can't. Charlie, you're forgetting history. The two best communicators in politics over the last 30 years, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. I'm sorry. And what you have a party's best communicators always are their presidential nominees or their presidents. And there's a lot of potentially good communicators out there. I don't think either Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden were very effective communicators. But look at some of those governors out there, or look at some of those members, candidates running this year for the House and Senate that we've interviewed on this program. There's a lot of great communicators in the Democratic Party, and there will become a time.
They got one of the best about 40 miles east of you. Just get in your car and drive to Frankfurt and see if you can catch a shot of Andy Beshear. He's an old world communicator, and I think he's going to prove it when he runs for president. By the way, there's going to be more of them. But we got him. The problem is we got to nominate him. We got to nominate him. Until we get a presidential candidate, we're all sitting around wishing and hoping.
Yeah.
But you got a potential one right there in Kentucky, I got to say.
You know, James, I'm going to probably change my mind seven times on this, but right now, my preferred ticket for 2028, which we should not talk about, it's too far away, too All much right. uncertainty. I just wrote a column about that. But in my heart of hearts, or my private moments, Beshear Slotkin. God, I love that ticket. Anyway.
I like both of them a lot. But I tell you what, if they get there, they're going to be really skilled because it's a competitive race. Let me tell you,
ooh, man. Right.
And that's what I'm excited about. Of everything that gives me hope and excitement, it's Beshear, Slotkin, the whole crowd of them.
Right.
And there's
right.
you know, we could name another eight names would be you know.
Well, how about the guests that we've had on this show, James? Well, I mean,
shit.
You know,
shit.
Wow. I mean, this class, I'll tell you something. We thought the class of 2018 was off the charts. I think this class, because I think most of them are going to be successful, is just as impressive.
I agree. To anybody that doesn't have hope or thinks that we're stuck in this sort of hopeless loop, please listen to this show and go back and listen to the other shows and listen to these congressional candidates we have.
Yeah.
It's so encouraging. So encouraging.
James, we're in our Rocky Mountain phase today. We had a great question from Utah. Now we have a great one from Idaho. Will.
Oh, wow.
Will in Boise says Democratic nominee David Roth has suspended his campaign, leaving Idaho voters with a clear choice between a long-serving incumbent and an independent Army veteran running on stewardship, fiscal responsibility, public lands, and rebuilding trust. Does this create a new political test case for the Mountain West?
I hope so. I mean, the same thing potentially we're trying to get to happen in Montana, Nebraska, or I guess not in the Mountain West, but I don't know.
It's already happened in Nebraska, right?
Already happening. And, you know, the country is in dire straits. The country is in real trouble. And if it takes some different kind of thinking or aligning with a different party or trying to win an election in a place that you hadn't won since Frank Church, I guess, I don't know when, then do what you got to do, man, but save the country. Save the country. And if this is what it takes, then let's get out. I think the guy, the incumbent's like 84 years old. I mean, I don't just find people that live in Idaho. Some of them are might misinformed, but that's not the case yet. You know, I think we make some appeals here. We can do pretty good.
I may be wrong, James. I think the same thing may have happened in South Dakota, too. I think a Democrat dropped out, maybe,
so too.
And there's independent.
This is a very, very positive movement. Do what you got to do to wrestle power away from these people who are ruining the whole country and the whole world. And it's legal. It's above board. Makes sense to me.
Let me just, one in particular, Alani Bankhead is the Montana Democratic nominee for the Senate. She is a very impressive woman. She has a great political future. She has, and it's a three-way race because Seth Bodner, the president of the University of Montana, has also entered. Bankhead, the Democratic nominee, has no chance of winning. None. For some inexplicable reason, former Governor Schweitzer is really, really, you know, pumping her up and encouraging her. She can't win. She really can't. Bullock and lost by, I don't know, 10 points, and John Tester lost by almost as much. Bodner has a chance. It might be tough, might be uphill even, but he has a chance. And Alina Bankhead, very impressive, great future. If you really, really, really think about what's best for your country, you do what they did in Idaho and in Nebraska and I think South Dakota. Drop out and let Bodner go head on against the Republican.
I'll second everything.
Okay.
I don't know. And I tell you, what I would be scared of if that were me, and potentially we lost a Senate seat that we could have won to stop this, I would be racked with guilt for the rest of my life. I would. Maybe different than me. I don't know.
Well, listen, please keep those questions coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Mint Mobile, Trust and Will, and Quince in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.